You're listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Anne Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Anne Lucas. This week, I learned a new word I never wanted to exist. Gazification. Gazification refers to Israel learning from everything it got away with in Gaza, and quickly applying whatever it can from that experience in Gaza to their occupation in the West Bank. This term defined a recent episode of the podcast Occupied Minds. The episode dropped on January 31st, 2025, and it was entitled The Escalation of Israel's Gazification of the West Bank. Occupied Minds is the podcast of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, also known by its abbreviation FMEP. The host, Laura Freeman, is the president of FMEP. And she is a leading authority on the Middle East with particular expertise in U.S. foreign policy in the region, on Israel-Palestine, and the way Middle East and Israel-Palestine-related issues play out in U.S. domestic politics, policies, and legislation. Laura is also a preeminent subject matter expert in the area of anti-Palestinian legislation and lawfare, including the weaponization and instrumentalization of the definition of and concerns about anti-Semitism. And Laura does this work as an anti-Zionist Jewish activist, among other titles and identities. In this episode, she is speaking with Dalia Hatouka. Dalia is a multimedia journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs. And she also specializes in regional Middle East issues as they pertain to business and economics, culture, art, and U.S. foreign policy. Dalia has been the recipient of many awards and fellowships. Most recently, she was awarded a fellowship with the Maynard Institute. Dalia has also been the recipient of the Kiplinger Fellowship in Public Affairs Journalism. Other institutions that have given her awards include the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, Religion News Foundation, International Women's Media Foundation, Rory Peck Trust, and the Overseas Press Club of America. So I'm going to keep my intro short so we can hear as much of the very important and insightful conversation between these two important experts as possible. Their insights into the West Bank and the Israeli occupation are so valuable to have, and I don't want to deprive you of any of what they have to say about it. We really do have a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go.
Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Laura Freedman. I'm the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is Thursday, January 23rd, 2025, and it is my great pleasure to have with me, back with me, I should say, today the preeminent journalist and political analyst, Dalia Hatouka, who I've been honored to host on this podcast previously. Welcome back, Dalia.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
So for those who don't already know her, and if you don't follow her, this is her work on social media and in the press and everywhere else, you should. You can follow her. I'll have links to all that in the show notes. But as a brief intro, Dalia is a multimedia journalist specializing in Israeli-Palestinian affairs and regional Middle East issues as they pertain to business and economics, culture, art, and U.S. foreign policy. I hope someday, Dalia, the situation will be such that I can have you back on the podcast to talk about things like culture, arts, business, and economics. That's not why I've had you on before, and not today. Dalia also writes about religion, fascinating minorities, and immigration in the U.S. You can read her work in major outlets around the world, including Washington Post, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, NPR, BBC, New York Review of Books, The Economist, Time, The Nation, The Intercept, Jewish Currents, The Guardian, and Al Jazeera, and that's not even a comprehensive list. And you can check out her bio and a compendium of her work at www.dalia.com. And then she is on X, It's at and Dalia Hatuka, her name. So we're going to just jump in. The reason I asked you, and I asked you on short notice to be with me, is to talk about what's happening in the West Bank. And just, you know, sort of brief introduction. So for 15 months, we all know most of the focus has been on Israel's war on Gaza, and more recently, its military offenses in Lebanon and in Syria. The West Bank has gotten sort of short shrift since October 7th. And this is despite the fact that there's been a lot happening in the West Bank since October 7th, where we see Israeli violence, including by settlers, by the IDF, by settlers enabled and supported by the IDF, by settlers in the IDF, increasingly impossible to disaggregate. It's violence has been escalating, lots of people being killed. And then, of course, since Sunday, January 19th, when the current ceasefire came into force, it has escalated further with devastating results on the ground already, and what appear to be even more devastating results going forward unless something changes. So we're going to talk about that today. I'm going to, for the sake of people's understanding of this, I want to break this down into sort of an arc. So I want you to first talk about the pre-October 7th situation in the West Bank, then we're going to talk about October 7th through the ceasefire, and then post-ceasefire. And there's a lot to cover, so I'm going to ask you to do this kind of telegraphically so we can get through it. And I'll have links to everything that we mentioned. So first round. So I want you to talk about the situation in the West Bank prior to October 7th, 2023. And here we're talking about with respect to IDF violence and settler violence, and the increasing, you can't really distinguish between the two. We saw that before October 7th. And just to give people some numbers as a reminder, according to the UN Office of the Coordinator of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, between January 1 and October 6, 2023, Israeli security forces had already killed 201 Palestinians in the West Bank. That's 2023 before October 7th. We also, as a reminder, February 2023, we had Israeli settlers rampaging in Hawara in the southern West Bank, in what was called a pogrom. And then we had, I'm just going to quote Yesh Din, the Israeli NGO, which said in 2023, at least 10 Palestinians were killed by settlers and dozens of homes and vehicles were set on fire in that pogrom. And they concluded that, quote, 2023 was the most violent year in settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank in both the numbers of incidents and their severity. So with all that, talk about, this is pre-October 7th in the West Bank.
So kind of like you mentioned, you know, 2023, there was already a war of sorts that was going on in the West Bank. And it was a war, obviously, against Palestinians. It was marked by settler violence, a surge in settler violence. And also the military, you know, was responding with increasing and more brazen complicity. Instead of maintaining order, you know, sometimes the army has to actually maintain order, even as an occupying force. But instead, the army has been acting as an enforcer for the settlers, especially because we've had figures like Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who's a staunch advocate for the annexation of the West Bank. He's gained power of late. So this has kind of transformed settler aggression into an overt strategy aimed at pushing Palestinians off their land. So again, there's been, you know, there was a sharp rise in settler violence. As you mentioned, it resulted in numerous casualties, mass displacement, significant property damage. And the violence has especially been harrowing for Palestinian Bedouins. In 2023, you know, I went around and I spoke to a lot of these communities, and you know, they're semi-nomadic people that the UN has said suffer the brunt of the occupation, and many of them have had to leave their lands because they no longer have that land. They've been replaced by let's say the Jewish Orthodox shepherd who is now, you know, using the land for his own livestock and whatnot. And these settler assaults have been more than just acts of aggression. They're, the vanguard of a campaign to push Palestinians out. And again, the military, rather than serving as a neutral arbiter, it's become an enforcer of the strategy. It's shielding settlers, it's punishing the victims. All of this is cementing control, an arrest, a land seizure, displaced family, all one at a time. I would say finally that before we move on to the next part, it's important to note that these changes have been happening. And this isn't just solely because of Smotrich, but it's partially and importantly because Netanyahu granted Smotrich the direct control over the civil administration, or what's known as the civil administration, which oversees Israeli settlements, effectively giving himself, he's a settler, control over key areas in the West Bank that were traditionally under the military's purview. And so this new administrative framework has led to increased settlement construction, authorization of new outposts, and a surge in land appropriations. And I think this power shift has emboldened Smotrich to accelerate the settlement growth at an unprecedented rate. He's openly stated that his aim is to cement Israeli control over the West Bank and prevent any possibility of a future Palestinian state. He's also said that he hopes that 2025, because Trump has now become president, would bring about the de facto or the formal annexation of the West Bank through settlement proliferation. And finally, like what I'd say is that, it's worth mentioning that the military has also started distributing thousands of rifles to settler militias, ostensibly for regional defense. But what it has done is it's effectively blurred the line between officially military forces and these what I would call vigilante groups. And I think this, marks a dangerous escalation in the West Bank.
Yeah, and just to remind people listening, what you're describing was happening before October 7th. I'm going to put some links into the show notes. Just to remind people, a new Israeli government came into power in December 2022. I'm reading here from a position paper that was released by a group of Israeli civil society NGOs, which described it as, with the formation of Israel's 37th government, release of its guiding principles, it has become apparent that Israel is moving towards the annexation of the West Bank. The coalition agreements openly express the intention to apply Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank, or in other words, annex it. So you had this clear intention. This started in December 2022 when this new government came in, which included Smotrich, it included Ben-Gvir, and we started to see changes in the organizing of the government that put key functions in the West Bank into the hands of Smotrich, security into the hands of Ben-Gvir, both of whom are clear, open, settlers and supporting settlements and all that. I'll also put a link to a piece from Yesh Din on the shepherding outposts. And I think we've actually maybe done a podcast on this. I'll check back. But this is something that I know some of our colleagues in the West Bank, both Palestinians and Israelis, have been following for years. And this is a phenomenon where you have these generally illegal outposts, which by using shepherding as their hook, are getting control over mass tracts of the West Bank. And with this new Israeli government, this became really a de facto formalized and government-approved policy. It was de facto already approved. Now it became really a clear tool of the government. So, all right, we're going to go forward. So that was before 2023. And actually, before we jump to after October 7th, I want you to just speak for a minute about the spasms of violence that we saw, with settler violence in particular on the ground, very just before October 7th. I mean, we had the Hawara rampage that was in February, but that had been repeated. Can you talk a little bit about this? And I think for me, this is an important thing to just remind people of, because of the perception or the talking point that we still hear today of there was peace, there was a ceasefire, everything was fine, And then October 7th changed everything as if nothing was happening before October 7th. So can you just take a second and talk about that?
Sure. So I'm not going to go into numbers, but throughout that time, there was essentially, like you said, pogroms that were happening, and that was a word that even Israeli officials had used to describe what the what Israeli settlers had been doing in the West Bank, essentially, setting fire to property, to houses, to cars of Palestinians, wreaking havoc, attacking schools even, just basically instilling fear in the hearts of everybody that, in the West Bank, in whatever village or town that they're attacking, especially these villages that are surrounded by settlements. Like there's a bunch that are in Nablus, for example. And then what went on was that, as you mentioned, there's always like this narrative of flare-ups, and this suggests that there were periods of calm during which, the Israeli forces aren't systematically attacking and erasing Palestinians. But in reality, the Israeli violence isn't an event. It's rather a system that operates 24/7 and 365 days a year. So even pre-October 7th, 2023 was one of the deadliest years on record since the UN started, or the UN OCHA agency started, looking at these numbers. I would definitely say that yes, 2023 was deadly in that sense, and also very frightening for people in the West Bank. But obviously, after October 7th, and little did we know that things could get worse, but they did.
Yeah, so we're gonna move to that now. And I think it's also worth reminding people, and this has always been true. I think it became clearer after the new government came in December 2022, that there is no right to self-defense in the West Bank. So if settlers are attacking your home, there is no police that you can call to protect you. There's no army that will protect you. And that what we've seen for decades, and Yeshdin has been documenting this for decades, is there's impunity for settlers. This is again pre-October 7th. To the present, there's impunity for the settlers who do attacking, and in many cases, they're actively enabled, if not aided and abetted, and we see this on video by the IDF. So that's sort of the overarching sort of story there up to the present when we see houses being burned and stuff. So let's talk about post October 7th through the ceasefire. So I want to note that back in August, you were already talking about the Israel's policy of Gazification, I think he's a Gazification of the West Bank. I'll put a link in the context of major IDF operations at that time. And I'm going to quote here also from 972 magazine, which wrote on December 4th, 2024, quote, "At least 57 Palestinian communities have been forced to flee their homes since October 7th as a result of settler attacks. Of these, seven have been partially displaced, and 50 have been wiped off the map entirely," which I think in a normal person would just say that's ethnic cleansing. And quoting Amnesty International as well, this is from February 5th of 2024. "Under the cover of the relentless bombardment and atrocity crimes in Gaza, Israeli forces have unleashed unlawful lethal force against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, carrying out unlawful killings, displaying a chilling disregard for Palestinian lives. These unlawful killings are in blatant violation of international humanitarian law and are committed with impunity in the context of maintaining Israel's institutionalized regime of systematic oppression and domination over Palestinians." All right, so on the ground, October 7th through January 19th, 2025, what happened?
Yes, a lot happened. So 2024, also, after October 7th, immediately after, I think most Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or Gaza, realized that what was coming was going to be hell on earth. in the West Bank, which is what I'm going to focus on, 2024 was very deadly. According to UN numbers, Israeli forces and settlers killed like something close to 500 Palestinians in the West Bank. But we also had a surge in Israeli demolitions, which reached a record high, close to 1,800 structures destroyed, which was 50% more than in 2023. And a quarter of these demolitions occurred during Israeli military operations and primarily in northern refugee camps. I think it's important to kind of note that. Settler violence also reached unprecedented levels in 2024. Again, we had casualties, property damage. There was, an increase from the previous year. There was a lot of forcible displacement as settlers attacked under the protection of Israeli forces. But I think it's also important to note that I want to mention the Palestinian Authority here because this took place this very large operation by the Palestinian Authority took place in 2024 on the 5th of December, whereby they besieged the Jenin refugee camp, and about 2,000 people had to be displaced from Jenin camp to Jenin city and the surrounding villages. Thousands others, stayed behind and struggled to meet basic needs. And it was such a shock, I think, for people, even Palestinians who are critical of the PA, because this was one of the largest operations that the PA had carried out since its creation, basically. And it reinforced this idea that the Palestinian Authority was in cahoots with the Israelis. And to make matters worse, is 2 days after the ceasefire started, Palestinian Authority forces left the area only for the camp to be bombarded by Israeli forces, including from the air, leading to the killing of at least 10 Palestinians. Interestingly enough, the operation has been called Iron Wall for me because I lived through the Second Intifada. It kind of brought back memories of Operation Defensive Shield. Even like the wording, I felt like it was kind of similar. And Netanyahu called it like a large scale and significant military operation meant to eradicate terrorism in Jenin. And not one single shot was taken by the Palestinian Authority, except against Palestinians, obviously, which withdrew as Israeli forces attacked by land and air. And now the fear is that this operation is going to last for weeks. At least that's what Israeli officials have been saying in local media. And it's not only frightening for the people of Jenin, but also people in the West Bank. And there's also a fear that, of what does this mean for the ceasefire in Gaza?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the PA. There's also on social media, there are reports that the PA is allegedly cooperating with the IDF now in Jenin. I don't know if you want to comment on that. We've sort of jumped ahead to the last point, which is talking about, actually, let's give it a second. I will come back to that. So we have the period of January of October 7th through the ceasefire, where we saw continual escalation. And anyone, you can look at any of the human rights organizations, Palestinian or Israeli, who've documented what were effectively revenge attacks exploiting the opportunity to grab land and push Palestinians off their land, and then Israeli military operations as well, which are framed as counterterrorism or, fighting, trying to get Iran, whatever they frame it as, there's no protection for any Palestinians on the ground. That's the bottom line. So on Tuesday, the day after the inauguration of President Trump, 2 days after the ceasefire started, Israel announced that it was launching Operation Iron Wall, which I agree, it brings back memories of the First Intifada. It also brings back, I mean, I think in terms of the language, it brings back for most, for a lot of us, at least for people who say, for as a Jewish person, it brings back Zev Jabotinsky's essay from 1923 about the Iron Wall. And I'm going to quote from that. He wrote, "Zionist colonization," because the early Zionists were happy to talk about being colonists, "Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population, behind an iron wall which the native population cannot breach." And you referenced what the government said they're going to do. I found an Israeli Hebrew language outlet, this is News 14, which quoted a senior security official as saying, quote, "Following the cabinet's decision to launch Iron Wall, we are embarking on a large-scale campaign in northern Samaria," that's the northern West Bank, "which could also take months. At the end, the terrorist camps will cease to exist as terrorist strongholds. What we did in Gaza will also be done in them." Anyone seeing the visuals coming out of Gaza, if they weren't following these on social media in real time, they're now finally coming out in the mainstream media everywhere. You can see what was done in Gaza, which was treating the entire place as a terrorist stronghold effectively, and we can destroy everything. You posted a thread on X yesterday. I'll have a link to it. And you wrote, "As soon as the ceasefire went into effect in Gaza, Israel, its army, and settlers literally and figuratively set the West Bank on fire." So I want you to talk a little bit more about this, about what's happening on the ground, about how you see it relating to the tactics in Gaza and the consent that was manufactured for those tactics to be used in Gaza and how that applies in the West Bank, how you see Israel's intent, and how you see this relating to the Trump administration. I mean, in terms of timing of ceasefire and what they think they can get away with. And also, I'm sorry, I'm giving you a lot in terms of how they see the Trump administration's attitude to Israel's ambitions for the West Bank.
Yeah, so since the ceasefire was signed, again, we saw a surge in Israeli settler attacks, but they were co coinciding with the Israeli military closing off the West Bank, sealing off villages and cities, and cutting them off from one another. There's already been at least two killings. There was a child who was killed near Nablus. There was a woman who, again, this big brings back memories of the Second Intifada. The ambulance that was carrying her, because she had symptoms of a heart attack, was not allowed to pass through a checkpoint, and she died. And we're also seeing, price tag attacks, which are, when settlers go around setting houses and cars ablaze, carrying them out. And I mean, it looks like it's apparent retribution for the Israeli army's failure in Gaza, or at least, like, for Israelis, that's what it is.
And by the
Or
way,
some or
it's worth adding that in the midst of all of this, the Israeli army shot and I think killed a couple of settlers who they thought were Palestinians, which led to mass protests by settlers against the army and also retribution against Palestinians, because Palestinians always pay the price.
Yeah, and all across, the West Bank, I've been seeing, like, these new metal gates that have been erected by the army to stop Palestinian movement. Even Jericho, a lifeline for people trying to get into Jordan and elsewhere around the world, has been sealed off, or people are made to wait for hours at a single checkpoint. But also, as is the case every time there's been a mass release of Palestinians from Israeli prisons, there's been these the Israeli army has gone around and detained almost the same amount of number, or very close to it. So, for example, we saw that there were 90 women and children who were released from Israeli prisons, and very shortly after the 90 were released, 60 others were taken from the West Bank in eastern Qalqilia. So, we can do the math there. And I think Palestinians' fears are also being reinforced by, this choking effect that's been happening, closures, checkpoints, like Bethlehem and Hebron, for example, are completely, like, sealed off. And as you mentioned, this is all coinciding with the inauguration of Donald Trump as a US president, who, I mean, for Palestinians at least, his administration, his last administration showed immense pro-Israel bias. He's being hailed by settlers who wish to see 2025 as the year he greenlights the formal annexation of the West Bank. And again, these fears are also being reinforced by the fact that, Netanyahu has changed these ever-changing goals of the war in Gaza to include the West Bank, particularly getting rid of so-called terrorism there and to change the security landscape in the refugee camps. Even Smotrich, I believe, said Israel's raid on Jenin is designed to change the security situation in the West Bank. And he talks about Gaza and Lebanon as well. This was a post on X, I believe. So it feels like the attack on Jenin refugee camp is very deliberate. And the things that were happening in Gaza are being kind of mimicked in Jenin refugee camp, namely the use of, besieging the camp, then using aerial fire on a very small patch of land, and also destroying infrastructure, leading to some of, I believe it's the Jenin governmental hospital. So that ambulances aren't able to take people to, to seek medical help. And even today, we saw pictures of Palestinian patients being made to leave the hospital under gunpoint. And you see these old men being carried by women and or kids or what have you. And these are all pictures that are reminiscent of what went on in Gaza. And honestly, it's very alarming, the not just the escalating violence, not just the iron wall, but like you said, we're seeing these like this force that's unnecessary, indiscriminate, disproportionate. We're seeing increased checkpoints, roadblocks, barriers. And at the same time, people don't have any, they don't have anyone to kind of seek help from, like especially the Palestinian Authority, because at the same time, the Palestinian Authority security forces actually went into one of the hospitals to detain some men who I believe like belonged to the Jenin Brigades or one of the other groups, militant groups that operate in Jenin. So obviously, to people, there's no, there's no salvation. There's no one out there to help them. And so I think that this is a reason why, in the first place, people started providing support and protection to these small militant groups that have popped up in some of the refugee camps.
Yeah, I think that you've described it just brilliantly there. I will say that, when I saw the when we start you started using the word Gazification, I think looking at it, a lot of us from October 7th, as analysts said, this is not going to be limited to Gaza. There's so many other Israeli ambitions, including Syria, including Lebanon. I think a lot of us predicted that, but certainly the West Bank. What is particularly, I think, alarming right now, or chilling even, is that as we go into this new period of Israel focusing on the West Bank, this idea that they have manufactured international consent for a conception of military action that allows them to define every person in the area as a legitimate target. So they're either militants, or if they've stayed there, they're now either in league with militants or they're human shields for militants. That's what they did in Gaza, which allows them to literally destroy everything and call it self-defense or preemptive self-defense, and to not be held accountable for anything. And when you've already got the consent from the world to do that on the scale you did it in Gaza, It is a chilling scenario when you think about West Bank, which is a much higher ideological priority for Israel and the Israeli right than Gaza ever was. Gaza was a problem. The West Bank has always been an opportunity. So that's something we're all watching, and I encourage people to follow Dalia, whose analysis daily is excellent. I want to sort of talk about an adjacent issue. And it was a set of issues. You and I spoke last, I actually think it was May 2023 was the last time I had you on the podcast to talk about the IDF's killing in the West Bank of Shireen Abu Atleh, who is your dear friend. People remember she was a prominent journalist and a US citizen. That is a killing for which Israel has never held anyone to account and for which the US administration, the Biden administration, never did anything to meaningfully seek, let alone obtain justice. Since then, particularly since October 7, 2023, we've seen Israeli policy and Israeli forces that, as a matter of Israeli policy and by the actions of Israeli forces, a targeting of international activists, including Americans. We had one American killed, a woman from Seattle. We've seen the targeting of journalists, including by the PA. I want you to talk about this, the role of the international aid workers, international humanitarian workers, human rights workers, and journalists, all of whom were active targets in to the extent that they were in Gaza. Israel treated them as active targets and the world tolerated that. To the extent that international media was not allowed into Gaza, you had Israel outlawing Al Jazeera to try to stop that. And then in the West Bank, where you've got all these groups being targeted, including not getting visas and being PA outlawing Al Jazeera. Talk about what that all means in terms of accountability and in terms of the ability of people to even know what's going on.
So, Israel's targeting of international activists, journalists, and what have you, humanitarians, it often comes under the guise of security concerns, and the harassment of people to the actual killing of people like Rachel Corrie in 2003. Starting then, and then like moving on to Shirin Abu Akleh, like you mentioned, and there were actually a few other Palestinians as well. Aisha Noor Ege, the Turkish American activist who was killed, I believe last year, or the year before, I can't remember the exact date. But anyways,
Just killed in September 2024.
2024, and it just seems to communicate a deliberate intention to stifle international solidarity with Palestinians, no matter what it is. So this strategy, I mean, effectively isolates Palestinian civil society. It limits global scrutiny of its policies. So we saw it, with the international solidarity movement back in the day, who, its activists were frequently detained at airports, deported, subjected to restrictions that inhibit their work. Human rights observers, even those from prominent organizations, have been targeted with accusations of bias. And the Israeli government, like you said, repeatedly denied entry to international figures, including lawmakers, journalists, even UN rapporteurs, while implementing measures to even, look into them and sort of do surveillance on them, intimidate them as well, because they're challenging Israel's narrative. And the thing is that I'll just mention that the international community's response has been disappointingly muted to these things. So, we see Western governments like quick to issue statements condemning repression elsewhere, but they often shy away from directly confronting Israel. And this inconsistency reflects the influence of geopolitical alliances and lobbying efforts, especially in the US and Europe, where criticism of Israel is often framed as politically costly or even taboo. So I think also the broader context of like growing authoritarianism worldwide has emboldened Israel to escalate its actions without fear of reprisal. And the fact that we've seen everything that it's done in Gaza being okay, like there's literally nothing that Israel has not done in Gaza. And it's been met with this eerie silence almost. And so I just feel like international law is it seems to be optional for powerful states like Israel, and that's why Israel's targeting of activists, human rights people, has largely escaped accountability. I will say also that we wanted to discuss the issue of what was the last thing that we were talking about? It was the
Well, the last thing I want to ask you about is UNRWA. I mean, I think it's worth
yes.
reminding people. So Israel has outlawed UNRWA. It becomes effective at the end of January. And what that means on the ground in terms of the humanitarian situation, because UNRWA, I think people don't understand, UNRWA is not just providing food and water and medicine, it's also the entire educational infrastructure for most Palestinians in virtually all Palestinians in Gaza and most Palestinians in the West Bank. I should also note that Amnesty International had their tax-exempt status stripped by Israel recently. People aren't getting visas. For me, some of that fits into sort of a broad story, which is, on the one hand, you have Palestinians, we're just focused on the West Bank now, Palestinians in the West Bank with no force that will defend them, either, defend them morally, spiritually, legally, or even physically their safety. And on the other hand, we see almost pre-first intifada return to a trying to isolate Palestinians and shut down what would be any sources of sharing information about what's happening, accountability. I note that if you listen to Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL, the problem isn't anything that Israeli soldiers are doing. The problem is that people are sharing it. Sharing their posts on TikTok and making Israel look bad, right? So the problem isn't what Israel does, the problem is that people know about it. I mean that's where that fits into. For me, you see these parallel tracks, completely vulnerable and being targeted, and an escalation in efforts to prevent anyone from knowing about it, let alone advocating for them or trying to defend them. But I want to talk about UNRWA. That was my last thing.
Yeah. So, Israel's efforts to obstruct the operations of international humanitarian organizations, and namely UNRWA, fall under the broader strategy of like trying to shield its policies from scrutiny and to erode avenues of support for Palestinians. So these measures, which include like denying visas to international staff, revoking tax-exempt statuses, and banning or restricting organizations like UNRWA, are calculated moves that aim to dismantle the infrastructure of solidarity, but also the assistance that Palestinians rely on, while also consolidating, as you mentioned, the control over the narrative and the ground realities. And so I think the outlawing of UNRWA is perhaps the most aggressive step in the strategy. I mean, Israel has long sought to undermine UNRWA's mandate, arguing that it perpetuates the refugee issue by recognizing descendants of Palestinian refugees as refugees themselves. But the thing is by criminalizing UNRWA's work and pushing for its defunding, Israel aims to weaken this institution that, again, you mentioned it provides critical education, healthcare, social services to millions of Palestinians. And even if they wanted to replace it by, like, let's say, UNHCR or the WFP or, some of these organizations, again, these organizations or agencies provide certain services, but don't provide all of these services that we are talking about. So the absence of UNRWA services exacerbates the dire humanitarian conditions in refugee camps, and it leaves an already vulnerable population with fewer resources and increasing reliance on local networks that Israel can more easily control or dismantle. And also, interestingly enough, if Israel does not want Palestinians to rely on the likes of Hamas or other, militant groups, then taking away UNRWA, by taking away UNRWA, it's effectively pushing people into the arms of these groups, because these are the groups that are actually going to provide relief and services and whatnot. And so I'll just finally say that, for Palestinians, I think the impact of taking away UNRWA, it's devastating because it serves as a lifeline. It provides critical services that Israel itself, as the occupying power, is legally obligated to ensure, but it systematically neglects. And so the void left by these groups deepens the humanitarian crisis. And it is also part of the larger narrative that delegitimizes Palestinian resistance and advocacy. And it frames it as either a security threat or a product of external manipulation. And the intent behind these moves is clear. It's to sever Palestinians from global solidarity networks and to make the occupation more sustainable by isolating and disempowering them.
Yeah, absolutely. I said that was the last question. I did say earlier we were going to circle back to the PA. And I actually, if you don't mind ending on this, I want to talk a little bit more about the PA. You talked about in December, its offensive in Jenin. We talked about even now it's seen as collaborating with Israel with its current offensive. What is going on? And also, let's be clear. The PA has been arresting journalists. It's not just that it outlawed Al Jazeera, it's been arresting journalists. I mean, what is behind these actions? What is it trying to, who is it trying to please? And what does this mean in terms of the if the PA already had a deficit of credibility with much of the Palestinian people, and right now we're having people talk about the day after in Gaza and the critical role the PA will have to play because Hamas can't be let back in power, all of that. What does any of this mean for the future of the PA if it was already discredited before?
So basically, I mean the issue on the ground that started all of this was the Palestinian Authority crackdown on a coalition of armed groups in Jenin refugee camp, and these groups are affiliated with the more traditional Palestinian factions like Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but even Fatah, the party that controls the PA. Unfortunately, like you said, the Palestinian Authority operating in Jenin camp has actually killed Palestinians. There was Shadha Sabbagh, a female journalist who had been speaking to residents in the camp about the security operation, and she was shot in front of her house, and her family blamed them, even though the Palestinian Authority denied responsibility. But 4 days after that, the Palestinian Authority went and banned Al Jazeera and closed their offices in Palestine. And that's very, very strange because Al Jazeera is believed to be the most popular, I would say the most popular media network in the West Bank. And but for people, the issue or the decision to do that is part of a broader attempt to silence criticism of its security operations in the Jenin refugee camp, because Al Jazeera was very big on showing what's happening in the camp. And I don't think the PA understood that at the time, all these images that were coming out of the camp were already on social media. It was like, citizen journalists or like, just random people showing what's happening. And so effectively, Al Jazeera was broadcasting what's already being said, but it was just too much for them. And so I think that when finally, Al Jazeera was shut down, people started talking, obviously. And a lot of people started saying, well, this is, they're trying to stifle free speech. And even though the PA says that what was going on is that there's that Al Jazeera was inciting hatred and disturbing public order and using all these like really strange excuses that we've heard from authoritarian authoritarian regimes like in Egypt and whatnot. I think the PA has repeatedly shown that it has little regard for the Palestinian people, and this is one of the ways it has done that. It has no issue with the implications of shutting down a network like Al Jazeera, even going as far as mimicking the Israeli occupation. So if you look at social media, there are these two pictures going around with Israel shutting down Al Jazeera's offices. And then here you see the PA also similarly coming in and handing over a decision to the office director, being like, okay, you need to shut down. But that's the thing, the PA doesn't seem to care. As far as Palestinians are concerned, many believe that the decision will affect, the coverage of their suffering to the world, especially, now that what's happening with, Israeli settlers and whatnot. And losing Al Jazeera, it affects the coverage, not just in the West Bank, but also in the Gaza Strip. And at the end of the day, this isn't about, restoring law and order, because the Palestinian Authority has been very clear that security cooperation with Israel is, as Mahmoud Abbas once called it, sacred. And so they are hoping that by going after these armed groups in Jenin refugee camp, I think the PA is trying to prove to Israel and maybe to international parties as well that it's able to handle governing the Gaza Strip when the war there ends. So I feel like that's the crux of it. But for the public, it just shows the increasing PA complicity in the occupation, all of which could fuel further unrest, I think.
All right, on that hopefully well that not hopeful note, but likely prescient knowing you because you tend to be right. We're gonna have to stop there. So Dahlia, thanks so much for joining me today. As always, I'm gonna warn you now that I will be asking you to come back for another conversation at some point soon. Thank you so much for our audience. Thank you for listening or for watching. This went on a little longer than I had planned, but I just wanted to ask you more questions. That is entirely my fault. For folks, don't forget to follow Dahlia on X and at Dahlia Hatuka. And as always, subscribe to Occupied Thoughts so you don't miss the great content we have coming out all the time, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify. And you can also find this podcast, both the video and the audio link, at www.fmep.org. And I'll have extensive show notes for everything we talked about. So with that, we're going to end it here. I'm Laura Friedman. Thank you, Dahlia Hatuka, and we're signing off until the next episode of Occupied Thoughts.
We are out of time, but I want to remind you that it does take a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Mohammed Al-Ghul and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.